Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 25 years ago, an iconoclastic eyeglass tycoon named Robert Graham had had enough of society's riffraff raising big, unremarkable families. He wanted those Americans just hanging on to make fewer babies, and movers and shakers with high IQs to widely share their genes with the next generation. At his house in Escondido, California, he founded what was dubbed the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank, and launched an era of genetic selection that may even now be only getting started. Tonight on Point, the history of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank and the once and future dream of genetically engineered kids. But first, more on today's verdict in the Michael Jackson trial. This afternoon, the pop superstar was acquitted of molesting a 13-year-old cancer patient at his Neverland Ranch and of all other charges. The verdict ended an often bizarre four-month trial that swamped much of the nation's media. For the latest reaction, we turn to David Jefferson, Los Angeles bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He joins us now from Los Angeles. David Jefferson, thanks for being with us tonight. What's the mood there?
Well, the mood, as you can imagine, is one of thank goodness it's over, for one. I was certainly up at Neverland and in the streets of South Central L.A., even down here, much jubilation over what's happening, despite the fact that Michael was subdued as he left the courtroom. You can imagine there's a huge sigh of relief at Neverland. And for DA Tom Snedden, a lot of wondering about how did I go wrong in this case.
What is the interpretation of what happened here? All charges simply gone. And what's the interpretation?
Well, it all comes back to reasonable doubt. When you look at the case, I think for those of us who were watching the case all along, it looked as if, while there were some compelling pieces of evidence, there really just wasn't enough there to connect the dots. What happened in the last couple of weeks, when you heard a lot of talk about would Michael be going down, would he be going to prison, a lot of that was based on the video testimony that the accuser had made to police when he first came forward with the charges. Now,
right.
A lot of people seem to think that might have influenced the jury into convicting, but the fact of the matter is they were also looking at other videotapes that showed this family supporting Michael Jackson, and certainly on the Martin Bashir video that caused this whole thing to come to light in the beginning, we had the accuser leaning on Michael's shoulder and, you know, talking about him as a father figure and what have you. So I think in the end, the case that Mesereau put forward on behalf of Mr. Jackson, that was saying essentially there is reasonable doubt here. This family could very well have been scamming Michael Jackson. The jury had to consider that and put aside their personal feelings of what they may have felt about how strange Michael Jackson's personal life may be.
David, was it a shocker there in Santa Maria, or had people seen this coming, or was this just a bolt from the blue?
I think it definitely was a shocker. Certainly the mood over the past week and a half had been that at least there would be a mix, that Jackson, if not convicted on the heavier charges, that would have given him the kind of prison term that we were looking at, that he would be convicted of some of the lesser charges, like feeding alcohol to minors and that sort of thing. But no, this was it was a surprise that it was a clean sweep.
And the media camp that is now there, does it just strike its tent and move away? Is that all over?
That's exactly what happens. It interviews the jurors, it interviews elated fans, and then all 2,000 journalists pack up their tent city and move on.
And David, what's your sense of Michael Jackson himself? I guess this is a clean slate. He's a free man. There's nothing hanging over him tonight. Was it possible to tell anything from his demeanor as he came in or left the courtroom, from any statements from his inner circle, any insight into his state of mind?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this case has taken an extreme toll on Michael Jackson. We've been told that the family, particularly over the past weekend, was keeping a 24-hour watch on him just to make sure, you know, there had been talk of, you know, would Michael kill himself if he were convicted or whatever. And certainly the family had gathered around him, and they were very concerned about Michael's well-being. As you know, he's been in and out of the hospital with these back problems. So what he looked like as he emerged from court was nothing more than completely exhausted, completely enervated, frail. I would expect we don't see much of him for a while.
Well, and tonight, a free man, not guilty on all counts. David, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
David Jefferson is Los Angeles Bureau Chief for Newsweek. He spoke with me from Los Angeles. In 1980, rich businessman Robert Graham founded the Repository for Germinal Choice in Escondido, California, with the hope that he might help create the next generation of Nobel Prize winners. He promised the seed of Nobel Prize winners to his would-be clients, and they came. One of his first sperm donors, William Shockley, the Nobel Prize winner who created the transistor and, like Graham, was an enthusiastic eugenicist. Although the sperm bank fell short of Graham's dream, it did produce more than 200 children and offered women something they did not have before, a menu of genes to choose from. Today, women can shop for the donors they want, and soon, who knows, maybe they'll be able to choose from a menu of the precise genetic traits they want in their children. Tonight on Point, the strange and telling history of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank and the future of genetically engineered kids. You can join the conversation. How much of the story of our lives is written in our genes? Are we already in the brave new world of gene shopping? Would you slow down for a billboard for Nobel Prize-winning sperm or just drive right by? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Plotz, deputy editor of the online magazine Slate. His new book is The Genius Factory, The Curious History of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. David Plotz, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
What a story. What a story. And what a strange man behind it. Give us a sense of Robert K. Graham. Who was he?
He was a very eccentric, very wealthy inventor. He had invented shatterproof plastic eyeglasses in the late 1940s and made a huge fortune, $100 million. But the wealth wasn't enough. And in the 60s, he really became obsessed with the idea that the human race was in genetic decline because imbeciles and morons and what he called retrograde humans were having too many children. In part, he was very conservative, and he thought in part this was because there were government welfare programs that were paying them to reproduce. And these were people who, if in a different era, would have died before they could have reproduced. And he thought this was a tragedy and that we were headed for global communist dictatorship as these imbeciles multiplied. And he came up with the idea of a genius sperm bank to counteract this. And he thought that if he could gather the seed of the world's smartest men and distribute it to smart women, women who belonged to the high IQ society Mensa.
And this was his original requirement, that the women had to also be extraordinary on the IQ front.
That's right. And he thought he could breed a cadre of brilliant future scientists, leaders, politicians, you know, soldiers, whoever it was, and they could hold off the idiotic hordes that were being fathered and mothered by the morons out there.
We're going to hear about exactly what he pulled off, but David Plotz, describe for us the history that he was part of, his kind of heir to this whole eugenicist, the history of eugenics that he was very much in the mainstream of.
Yes,
having a kind of revival at that time. Lay that out for us.
Eugenics was a fascinating and appalling idea that took hold in the United States and Great Britain in the last half of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th. And we've really kind of wiped it from our history books. But the idea was that you should breed the best people together to get a stronger germplasm, was the term, a stronger race. They meant more strong white people, essentially. And moreover, you should stop the weaker people, the alcoholics, epileptics, the Amish, people who suffered from mental illness. You should stop those people from breeding, and you might stop them from breeding by castrating them or some other form of sterilization, or you might stop them from breeding by, ultimately, in the case of the Nazis, who took eugenics to its nth degree, to its horrific extreme. You might stop them from breeding by simply killing them. Mm. And eugenics took hold in the United States from 1900 until the Nazis discredited it and led to forced sterilization of tens of thousands of Americans and eugenics classes being taught at all American major universities and American eugenicists writing textbooks that were translated into German that Hitler read and right. was and, inspired by.
And all that on putting the blocks to the reproduction of the undesirables as they would have had it. But there was a positive side, too, that Robert Graham pointed to. We'll talk about those 215 kids who were born out of his sperm bank, but you call them messengers from our future. This is not just history as you see it, David.
That's right. We're on the verge of an age of genetic expectations. And what I mean by that is that in the coming few years, few decades, we're increasingly going to be able to manipulate the genes of the embryos that we want to become our children. And we'll be able to put in genes that correlate to intelligence or physical abilities of various sorts or beauty or height. And we will therefore sort of begin with this genetic expectation of what our children can be like. We'll be programming our children to be genetically better than they would have been had Mother Nature been in control. And I think the children of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank, who were themselves children of genetic expectation, can teach us a lot about what to expect from when we try to program children for genius.
David Plotz is author. David, stand by for a moment. We've got to take a break here. David Plotz is author of The Genius Factory, The Curious History of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. You can join our conversation tonight. How much of the story of our lives is written in our genes? And have you shopped for sperm or an egg for your child? What was on your shopping list? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the saga of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank and the once and future dream, more and more a reality, of genetically engineered babies. My guest tonight is David Plotz. He's author of the new book, The Genius Factory. You can join us. Have you shopped for sperm or an egg for your child? And what was on your shopping list? Tall, dark, and handsome, super IQ, luck of the draw. Are we headed inexorably toward more and more choices on a menu of genetic traits for our children? Is this good, bad, inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Plotz, you write that the biggest day in the saga of the sperm bank, and in a way its most disastrous day, was kind of its opening day, February 29th, 1980, when it went public and ran into a kind of disgrace all at the same time. Take us to that moment.
It was Leap Day, which I think is really appropriate for such a bizarre event to occur. And the Los Angeles Times ran an article announcing the birth of this Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. And the author of the article contacted every Nobel Prize winner he could find in California. And finally, after calling 22 of them, he reached William Shockley, who had won the Nobel Prize for inventing the transistor and had founded the first company in Silicon Valley and was a really, giant of American science.
But also hugely controversial by 1980.
Yes, we'll get to that in one second.
Yeah.
So Edwin Chen reached Shockley, and Shockley said, yes, this is a wonderful idea, and I've participated. And immediately, this proved that this Nobel Prize Sperm Bank was not a joke or a trick that Robert Graham was pulling, that he really did have Nobel Prize sperm that he was distributing. But Shockley was such an incredibly controversial figure that the sperm bank became a joke. And the reason Shockley was a controversial figure is that he was this racist eugenicist who went around the country talking about how low the IQs of African Americans were and how people with low IQ should be sterilized, and generally, outraging people all over the country.
There was a time when everywhere he spoke, there were protesters outside.
That's right.
Shouting.
He'd be burned in effigy. They would, his classrooms would be Mau Mau'd. And Shockley's involvement turned this project, which had seemed sort of bizarre, but an interesting kind of futuristic excitement, too. It had an interesting kind of futuristic excitement. It turned into something very sinister, both something sinister and goofy all at once,
right.
That it seemed like a joke, but it also seemed scary in the sense that Shockley had such a negative image, and he seemed so Hitlerian in his own views that the bank was disgraced. Saturday Night Live ran a skit making fun of it. You know, columnists all over the country just had a field day taking, you know, a bat to William Shockley's head. And as a result, this bank, which had, you know, launched with such hoopla, immediately kind of dove back into a hole and hid in the hole for the next 20 years. But it did, while in that hole, it continued to get hundreds and hundreds of women came to the bank and applied and wanted some of the special sperm.
And this is where the story to me, David, gets really amazing and points to the future, that in spite of this kind of disastrous opening that you describe and all that dark tinge and shadow around it, people lined up. And as you say, these women were no longer patients. They became customers. They were shopping. And that kind of shopping was something that was radical, that was new in Graham's hands.
It was completely new. And I think it's hard looking back from today when infertility, you know, you practically go to the gym and someone talks to you about their infertility problems, when infertility is everywhere and everyone tells you everything about it all the time, to remember that if you think back to 1980, infertility really had a stigma attached to it. If you were a woman who was infertile, a couple who was infertile, and you went to your doctor and he was going to give you donor sperm, he would grab the nearest medical student who might have the right blood type or hair color or eye color, but probably didn't. And he would give you the sperm, and you would go home, and you would be expected not to talk about it, and you would be expected to be grateful. What Robert Graham did is he all of a sudden turned women into shoppers for sperm donors. He published a catalog listing in elaborate detail the wonderful qualities of these donors, their IQs, their accomplishments, their hobbies, their personality types, their, you know, health history. And these men were kind of like the Godiva of sperm. And the women who came to his bank were enthralled by it. And they loved the chance to be shoppers rather than patients, consumers rather than patients. And it revolutionized how American women started to think about fertility. And every sperm bank in the country was soon following suit and soon offering these elaborate catalogs of donors and seeking out donors who would be smart and tall and handsome and healthy. And soon every sperm bank in America was a kind of genius sperm bank or a eugenic sperm bank.
And of course, out of that, the sperm bank business just exploded. At this point, 1 million Americans can trace their fatherhood to a sperm bank, 30,000 a year. And this pattern of choosing from a giant, in-depth, detailed menu of traits of the father is now absolutely par for the course. It is everywhere, David Plotz.
That's right. It's, you know, if you go to California Cryobank or Fairfax Cryobank, it's like, what is it like? It's like shopping for a DVD player, except a DVD player where your, you know, the features are the hair color, the SAT score, the ethnic background, the health history are the features you're looking for. And it's a quite addictive kind of experience. It's like dating almost. You really get to know these guys quite intimately. In some places, they will show you baby photos of the guys. You can listen to them on audio tape. You can read their answers to essay questions. I mean, you would learn more about a sperm donor that you were shopping for than you probably know about, you know, most of the girls that you, or the boys that you had dated in high school.
And in that, what I see you writing about here, David Plotz, is a shift from the kind of old top-down dream of eugenics where, you know, some czar of reproduction would tell people whom they would mate with and who would and would not mate, to a really, to a consumer-driven kind of genetic choice function here as we head into more and more options for genetic engineering opens up a truly brave new world of people making all kinds of choices for their kids.
That's exactly right. But that point, I think, is very important to remember, which is that in the old days of eugenics, it was the state who was going around sterilizing people, or the state was telling who should be married to whom. And these days, the consumer choices are being made at an individual level, and it's a private form of eugenics. So each individual parent is attempting to get the best child it can by picking certain genetic traits or certain traits in a sperm donor or an egg donor.
David Plotz,
so it doesn't have a it has it's less sinister in that way.
Less sinister, but open to all kinds of kind of menu shopping here. David Plotz, author of The Genius Factory, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation a woman who is in the midst of this very process. Jennifer Waddell joins us tonight from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. She is 7 months pregnant with twins. Both the eggs and the sperm came from donors. She's 42 years old, single. Jennifer Waddell, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
So you have gone the whole distance here, and not just to a sperm bank, but you've shopped for an egg as well?
Yeah, that's what it turned into. Didn't start out thinking it was going to be that. But
What put you on that path, Jennifer?
Well, I've always wanted children. I haven't met anybody worth really spending more than a month with. So I decided I would go to sperm bank. Actually, no. I first started with a friend, trying to get pregnant with a friend's sperm, and that didn't work. Moved on to the sperm bank. That didn't work. Moved on to fertility treatments. Nothing worked. Finally discovered a year later that I was infertile, and the only way I was going to have a baby was to either adopt or use donor egg.
Which you plunged right ahead and did, and now you find yourself not just pregnant, but pregnant with twins. Tell us about the process of shopping for the donor egg, for the donor sperm. How specific were the traits that you were offered in those donors, and what did you look for?
Well, it's funny. If I were dating, I would date a very different person from who I chose for my sperm. You have to remember, when I chose my sperm, I thought it was going to be my egg. So sort of figured, pick somebody who looks remotely like me, or at least has some of the same coloring, because I don't want this person to feel so out of the family, this child to feel so out of the family. It's odd enough only having one parent. I mean, it isn't anymore, but so I chose somebody with the same ethnic background, which surprised me, but that's what I did. And he's tall. Have no idea of what he looks like, but he sounded nice. Mostly I was looking for somebody who sounded well-adjusted, friendly, outgoing, somebody I'd like to have a conversation with.
And you could get a sense of all of that from the profile that the sperm bank offered you.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, as David was saying, you get to read answers to essay questions. You get to see the health history and the SAT scores. I didn't care. I mean, the health history, yes, I care about, of course. But
but you're looking for someone that you would like. David Plotz, here's Jennifer. She's single. She's 42. She's now not only carrying one, but two twins from this process, and not just from a sperm donor, but an egg donor as well. How does she fit or not fit the general profile of the people, the women who are going out and doing this?
Well, first of all, Jennifer, congratulations.
Oh, thank
and good
you.
Luck. she fits it in a very interesting way, which is first of all, in one particular way, which is that she is a single woman, which is something that a generation ago, had Jennifer wanted to do this, she would have run into a huge obstacle. There would have been sperm banks would have turned her away, would have been very leery of her.
Robert Graham would not give sperm to single women.
That's absolutely right. And most sperm banks wouldn't in you know, 25 years ago. But today, the single women and lesbian couples are the driving force in the sperm bank business. Another way in which she's like a lot of sperm donors, people who've used donor sperm, is that she sought a tall sperm donor. This is probably the greatest axiom.
Because I'm tall.
Okay, tall, but it also turns out that everybody, or most, wants a tall donor.
That's right. There's sperm banks won't really take sperm donations from short men because nobody will choose short sperm donors. It's as iron a law as there is. And I think that also the way in which Jennifer seems to have looked for personality indicators rather than necessarily sort of absolute intelligence, but the niceness, the idea of temperament as being something that people care about more than they care about intelligence, I think is a real signal. I mean, people do want to end up with a child that is likable more than they particularly care about a child who is brilliant.
Jennifer, let me ask you a couple things. First of all, do you think that you have a sense of what your children may be like from that kind of characterization of the donor's personality? How much confidence do you put in the kind of genetic envelope?
None. I mean, it's nice that I like the sound of the woman and I like the sound of the guy. The guy's probably all of 20 years old. He sounds silly. He's 20. But I don't think that the children's personalities are going to come from their genes. I think they're going to come from living with me and whatever kind of extended family I give them.
And look down the road, Jennifer. What issues do you expect to arise with these children? And like David, I say congratulations. You wanted kids. You're pregnant now. You'll have them. What special issues are you looking forward to in explaining sort of where they came from and who they are?
That's a hard one because I really don't know. I mean, my lawyer told me, you tell them early, you tell them often. You have to tell them right away that you've got to get donor egg, donor sperm into their vocabulary before they have any idea of what it means, so they don't feel like you've pulled any punches on them. Children resent their parents for all sorts of reasons. I worry that they'll resent me for doing this, for creating them just basically from two internet sites. Why didn't you adopt? Stuff like that. But I think the only thing I can hope is that they'll be happy. And not resent, not go through a resentment and really wanting to know who their generic parents are, because they can't. It's all anonymous.
Happiness, the thing that every parent wishes for, but in this case, they will not be able to know that genetic origin. Jennifer Waddell, thank you very much for sharing your story with us tonight, and good luck with your pregnancy.
Thanks.
I want to turn to our callers. They've been waiting patiently. Jim is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'm a geneticist, and it's an interesting conversation that you're having in that we're talking about phenotype. We're talking about people's traits and who they are. But again, everybody has to remember that's only half of the traits that you're getting from the sperm. And there are 30,000, in excess of 30,000 genes in the genome, and it's that combination of both mother and father that gives us who we are. And nurture is such a strong part of this. Even as a geneticist, I recognize that how we are developed is so much is so much influenced by how we grow up, and it's good to hear that Jennifer didn't expect any kind of special personality trait out of that, because that's so much more formed by our nurturing environment as opposed to our genetics.
Jim, that's a great point. Stick with us for a minute here. David Plotz, first of all, is Jennifer typical in that? I got the sense reading your book that an awful lot of the customers that came to the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank had specific traits in mind that they would like to see in their offspring.
I think at the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank, there was a bit more of it than there is at other sperm banks, because it would attract the kind of mother who was particularly concerned with accomplishments. And so they were looking for guys who were particularly intellectually accomplished and had other accomplishments. But I also think, I don't want to overstate that. I mean, I think once those mothers had their children, when presented with the reality of a child, you tend to think about the child differently than in the theory of the child, so that they've adjusted to who their children are very well.
And what about Jim's point that a kind of gene worship can creep in here, the thought that this will be so determinant?
It's a great point, and it's something I really hit on a lot in The Genius Factory, which is that, to me, the important trait of the important defining thing about the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank was not really the sperm, because it turned out the sperm donors weren't Nobel Prize winners. They were, they were accomplished professors, but they weren't
most of them.
Right. But what was defined this sperm bank was that the women who went there were very serious about having accomplished children. The kind of woman who's going to go to a Nobel Prize sperm bank is the kind of woman who's really determined to raise a child who's going to be accomplished. And when I look at these children that I've met from this bank, they're quite accomplished, and they've achieved a lot. Some of them have wonderful artistic talents and physical talents. But I look at that as a real credit to the nurture of these mothers, who were very involved mothers who took raising their children as a very serious task, which is why they went to this bank to begin with.
And you quote one of them, maybe the most prominent offspring of this project, saying, "It was a screwed up idea making genius people. The fact that I have a huge IQ does not make me a person who's good or happy." Jim, in Madison, where do you think we're headed here? You're a geneticist. The possibilities for trait selection appear only likely to grow.
That's very true. And I think that what you're going to see first is And what we're seeing now is the selection against diseases, if you're carrying diseases, developing tests to determine that prior to implantation or any type of fertility treatment. And that's being done now in the private world. So we're certainly halfway there.
We're going to hear more about that after a break. Jim in Madison, thanks very much for your call. David Plotz, stick with us. We're talking tonight about the saga of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank and the once and future dream of genetically engineered babies. You can join us. How do you feel about trying to select traits in the next generation? Is this just an extension of choosing a mate, or is this weird? And should lines be drawn here somewhere, where or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the saga of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank and the once and future dream, more and more a reality, of genetically engineered babies. David Plotz joins us tonight. He's deputy editor of the online magazine Slate and author of the new book, The Genius Factory. You can join us as well tonight. Are we already living in the brave new world of gene shopping? And are we headed inexorably toward more and more choices on a menu of genetic traits for our children? Is this good? Is it bad? Is it inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now from Chicago by Dr. Bruce Lahn. He is a professor of human genetics at the University of Chicago, specializes in developmental genetics, molecular evolution, and stem cell biology. Dr. Lahn, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So here we're hearing the story of a sperm bank, which seems like a blunt instrument given where technology is going these days. David Plotz describes how now people can do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Look at just correct me if I'm wrong, but like an 8-cell embryo created by IVF, in vitro fertilization, and begin to choose traits or to choose against traits. Are we headed into the technical possibility of choosing specific traits in our offspring, Bruce Lahn?
I think the answer is correct. Genetics research has promised to not only identify genes that underlie disease traits, but also genes that underlie what most people would consider normal variations, such as variation intelligence or beauty. And currently, the research has been focused on genes that underlie diseases, and perhaps not before long. I would predict within the next 5 or 10 years, we would know a lot more about genes that underlie traits such as intelligence or beauty. And if people have made conscious choices as to whether they want to have kids with or without a certain disease, it wouldn't surprise me if traits that are more in relation to non-disease situations such as intelligence or beauty would also be selected. The second aspect of genetics research... go ahead.
No, please, let us hear it.
Yep, so the second aspect of genetic research is that it may actually lead to ways to not only select for existing variations within the human population for more desirable traits, but actually to engineer new traits into the human genome. And I see that as something that's going to be easily 20 or maybe even 50 or 60 years away.
David Plotz, how about it? You say that whether it's 5 or 50 years away, we are headed toward this kind of world where this consumer dynamic kicks in and people will be choosing tagged genes associated with musical ability, blue eyes, intelligence. Do you see it as inevitable, David?
I do think it's inevitable. I don't obviously know the science the way Dr. Lahn does, but that's always been the pressure. But I also think it's important to remember that, you know, most people are going to continue to reproduce the old-fashioned way, which is easier and more fun and very efficient at creating babies.
Thank heavens.
And I think that this is going to be limited to people who for one reason or another, because there's disease in their family or because of some kind of strong infertility issue, are driven into this into this.
And do you I don't really believe that? Because as I read between the lines of what you're writing here, you write about the kind of intense competition that's out there already between families and parents, you know, to have the most accomplished kids, the most high-achieving kids. I mean, will it really be just a defense against disease? Will it keep from becoming part of the kind of rat race of success?
I think until it becomes incredibly easy and incredibly cheap, it will be a very small minority of people who are doing it. Because it's also sort of risky, and it's and why, if you can perfectly well have most people believe that they themselves are genetically pretty fit to begin with,
yeah.
So they're willing to take the chance that their own children will be genetically fit, and if you don't have to go into this world, I mean, as anyone who's been through infertility treatments knows, it's a very unpleasant process. If you don't have to do it, I think you won't do it. But if you are driven into it, then you know, you'll go for the best thing you can.
And yet there's a lot going on already. Earl is calling from Boston. Hi, Earl. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What do you know, Earl?
I wanted to contribute from a couple of different perspectives. One is this perspective of a donor at one of these specialty banks.
That is, you are a sperm donor.
Yes, at one of these donor banks featuring donors with particular characteristics.
That is, high accomplishment of some kind. What's your high accomplishment, Earl? What do they want you for?
I was approached when I was a doctoral student at Harvard to participate in one of these donor programs.
And so how do you feel about it? Do you feel like you're making the world a better place by sharing your Harvard PhD sperm with unknown women?
That's not clear. I would like to think that the prospective parents will be happy with what they receive, but you know, I think it's more of a personal thing than a utopian sort of strategy of mine or the sperm banks to, you know, engineer a better world.
Do you think you're passing on intelligence, Earl?
Well,
exceptional.
I'm pretty sure that I am, because that's one of the other primary things that I really called about, is to challenge the prevailing disinformation that gets issued by people like Jim, that the vast majority of personality and ability traits are formed environmentally, which is absolutely untrue.
Let us pick that up, Earl, and thanks very much for your call. Dr. Lon, let me put that to you. How much of intelligence is transferable from one generation to the next by the genetic material, by in this case, a sperm donor? Is that old-fashioned?
I was going to comment on that,
yes, please.
Too. Several callers and commentators have said that intelligence and personality are perhaps not so genetic. It turns out that intelligence, at least as gauged by certain measures, and as well as several aspects of personality, are very, very genetic, far more genetic than what most people would have liked to believe. So it's certainly true that a person who has a particular level of intelligence and a set of personalities are more likely to transmit, to have kids who have similar personalities and levels of intelligence than otherwise. So to say that you know, genetic contribution is very small is wrong. But on the other hand, nurture is also very important. So, you know, while recognizing the importance of nature plays a very important role here as well. So, you know, there's definitely no doubt that the donors to these sperm banks who are chosen for particular reasons, biological traits, are going to enrich in the population the genes that contribute to those traits.
David Plotz, can you feel the market for this sperm bank business growing as Dr. Land describes that inheritability of intelligence?
Right. Well, I think the important phrase that Dr. Land used there is in a population, and I think that's one of the key distinctions that people have to make when they go into one of these sperm banks, expecting that if they only choose a sperm donor like Earl, who has this, you know, wonderful intelligent genes, that they will therefore definitively end up with an intelligent child. What you end up with are, you know, statistical sort of biases towards more likely to have a more intelligent child if you have a more intelligent donor, but there's no certainty in it. And that I think is always the thing to remember, that when you're out there shopping for these sperm donors, that you have a better chance when you do this, but DNA always has a certain amount of serendipity, which sperm cell you end up getting will determine a lot. And so your child may end up, you know, may not be the brightest bulb in the packet.
And David, we've just got a minute left here, so you have to make it brief. But when you went out and found through the internet, I don't know, a couple of dozen or 30 of these children of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank, how did they feel about their origins, about the ambitions behind their creation?
There was a variety of feeling, but most of them were pleased. Most of them felt they'd been given a little something extra. Not that it had determined who they were, but that they were glad to have that little, a little bit of help from their sperm donor father, and they thought it was something special about themselves. And they were mostly happy about that.
Dr. Lahn, do you expect there will one day be laws governing what can be passed on through genetic engineering one generation to another?
Well, that's a possibility, but I think that this is driven by market, and as long as there's a demand, people make laws, especially in a democratic system. I would imagine that, you know, laws cannot govern people who don't want to be governed in a certain way. So if there is a market this kind of a private eugenics, as David put it, I think that there may be laws initially, but over time, I think those laws will probably have to give way to human desire, ultimately.
Money talks, and watch out, here comes the future. Dr. Bruce Lahn at the University of Chicago, we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thanks for joining
us.
Thanks
for having me.
And David Plotz, author of the new book, The Genius Factory, The Curious History of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. David, thanks very much for the book and for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Michael Jackson is found not guilty on all counts. This is On Point. So, Michael Jackson beat it. Today, in a California courtroom, the 46-year-old pop star was acquitted on all charges in his child molestation case. Jurors rejected the prosecution's portrayal of Jackson as a predator who preyed on young children. The 4-month trial drew a media frenzy that provided some memorable images, including the defendant dancing on the top of his SUV outside the courthouse, and a star-studded celebrity witness list. Thousands of reporters descended on the courthouse for the verdict. Michael Jackson has long fascinated the American public that just can't seem to get enough titillating details about his unorthodox life. Before we close this chapter on Michael Jackson, we want to take a look for a moment at the frenzy in Santa Maria, California, and what it said about the pop star and about American culture today. Joining me now from Santa Cruz, California, is Tricia Rose, chair of the American Studies Department at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and author of Longing to Tell, Black Women Talk About Sexuality and Intimacy. Tricia Rose, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And with us from Washington is Paul Fari, style reporter for The Washington Post. He spent a month in California covering the Jackson trial. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tricia Rose, first to you. I'm sure you've been watching this with some amazement, if not dismay. What do you make of the incredible vortex of media interest around this, of public interest around this trial?
Well, you know, it's not surprising given the enormous imperative for the mass media to be a source of entertainment. And I think it's very important for our listeners to really pay attention to this critical shift in our media news outlets from news to entertainment, because that really frames the frenzy and hysteria. But even keeping that in mind, it is unbelievable the degree of media circus that Michael Jackson provokes and the profits that he generates as a result.
Paul Fari, you were there in that mass of reporters for a month. What was the tone among the reporters? Were they, you know, rabidly looking for every detail and or cynical about the whole thing? How would you describe the kind of atmosphere in the media camp?
Well, I was actually surprised by the diligence and maybe discipline of the reporters. You had reporters from the tabloids on up to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the allegedly respectable media, and I think there was a certain amount of integrity and, you know, actually pretty good reporting. Part of that was driven by the fact that the judge in the case, Rodney Melville, did not want to be Judge Ito like in the O.J. Simpson case. He banned cameras from the courtroom, and he tried as hard as was humanly possible to keep this from becoming a circus. And so they had learned, I think, by the accumulation of celebrity trials over the years, how to bring this down to a reasonable level and keep the circus from getting out of control.
Although you mentioned the print media, and I'm thinking here specifically also of electronic media, television in particular, which I'd be interested in hear your take on that, but I found the coverage of it on cable television and sometimes network news to be quite different than what you've characterized here.
Well, there was, I thought, less hysteria than there was around the Jackson trial, and maybe even less so than around the Peterson trial, the Scott Peterson murder trial that it immediately preceded it. Considering that Michael Jackson is an international superstar and that there was press from all around the world, you know, this was not one of the moments where you said, oh my God, we're out of control. There were certainly times when I say that watching the media, but this was not really one of them.
And yet, all those hours that were chewed up by this trial and every little bit of the minutia.
Absolutely. All the things we didn't learn about because we were watching nothing about the Michael Jackson trial over and over and over again. I mean, surely there's worse cases of media hysteria, but I think we're taking for granted the idea that mass media news, that their job is to overly examine relatively insignificant information in the world of human behavior for no particular purpose except ratings. I mean, once we accept that, then, yeah, sure, it was not so bad compared to some other high-profile trial.
Tricia, let me ask, I want to turn here for a moment to Michael Jackson himself, and I wonder from each of you, Tricia, first to you, how do you end up seeing him coming out of this as an icon, a totem, a human? Do you see him as exploited by the whole thing or fairly judged, let off easy? What's your sort of meta judgment here?
Well, I think that I'm surprised that about the result of it in many ways because of the media's coverage was so vastly different than the outcome suggested. But, I think Michael Jackson is both vulnerable and savvy, as the rest of us are, but he does everything writ large because he's highly visible and has an enormous ego, I would imagine. So on the one hand, I think he has been made quite vulnerable by this whole thing, but I also think that he has been very astute in his career and figuring out how to manipulate the media and to play into what he understands to be the entertainment business. So I don't really feel any differently about him than I did before the trial as a person and as an artist, but I do feel a little bit differently about this whole, it was a sort of cherry on the top, a sort of final culmination in this really excessive way of understanding, you know, entertainment as this ever-expanding place. We didn't learn anything really about the complexity of molestation charges in any really serious way. We didn't learn anything from all of this in terms of mass media coverage about what kinds of people get molested under what kinds of circumstances. There are lots of things we could have learned about.
Paul, we've just got 10 seconds here. Do you see justice coming out of this today?
I was actually surprised by how the Jackson camp tried to tamp down the media. They never spoke to any of us. That every morning they would brush in past us.
And yet there was the dance on the top of the SUV that we will not forget. Paul Fari with The Washington Post, grateful to you for being with us tonight. And Tricia Rose, University of California at Santa Cruz, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.